Hi, Jim.
Hi, Bob.
How are you?
I'm fine, thanks. Nice to be here once again on Blogging Heads.
Well, it's always nice to have you. And you come to us from the New America Foundation again?
I am.
Where you are Jim Pinkerton, a fellow there, among other things, as well as a contributor to Fox News.
Right. And that's what higher titles and frequent blogger header. So what more could I ask for?
I would say that should fill your income needs for the next few minutes. And I'm Bob Wright of Blogging Heads TV. And we're going to talk about a bunch of stuff. You know, I wanted to start out by asking you whether you consider yourself a Tea Partier.
I certainly consider myself in great sympathy with them. I've actually been to a Tea Party or two. So I guess in that sense, sure, why not? I'm a Tea Partier.
Whoa. So this was an on-air declaration. You came out.
I mean, just for total clarity, it's not a party.
Right.
It is not. I don't have an ID card. I don't think anybody has an ID card.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, beware the Tea Party movement when they
right
start selling, you know, memberships and so on. But in terms of thinking that America needs a new direction, absolutely.
Well, I believe America needs a new direction, but I don't think Tea Party. So you're going to have to elaborate. What qualifies you as a Tea Partier?
Being a U.S. citizen.
Well, I'm two for two. Maybe I am a Tea Partier and just didn't realize it. I'm a citizen who thinks America should change. But just for the record, why don't you list a couple of other things?
I think that fear that the government is getting too big and fear that the American way of life will change loom large in Tea Party thinking. Now, I should hasten to say that I don't believe that every member of the Tea Party is a hardcore Hayek-reading, Ayn Rand-reading libertarian by a long shot. I think a lot of them are, in the most literal sense, swing voters who may well have voted Democratic or even voted Obama in the last few cycles, as the country was wont to do in 06 and 08. So I don't think that this being a fan of, you know, various Tea Party candidates means that you have to then support, you know, the most doctrinaire positions. I just think it's a healthy expression of democratic small D democratic exuberance that is one of those things that makes you feel good about being an American, that people are free and can organize and self-organize in these new dramatic ways.
They are fiscally conservative, generally, right? I mean, they're concerned about the deficit, and I guess the thing they most agree on among themselves as to how to attack that is to cut spending, right? I mean,
right. I think deficits are really. I mean, that's your once again the semantic infiltration of the senator trying to say, oh no, what you worry about is deficits, because the implication being that deficits can be closed by tax increases. If you say the problem is the deficit, then you can say, well, why not have a tax increase? That's just as good a deficit closer as a spending cut. I don't hear the Tea Partiers talking about deficits. I hear them talking about spending.
They are small government fiscal conservatives.
Right.
I mean, they're not all supply-siders, on the other hand, by any means, right?
No, I think a lot of them just have a moral objection to big government bailouts. And the supply-siders, who were brilliant and have a great contribution to make, the problem they had, certainly within the Republican Party, was they were a little too agnostic. If you cut taxes and you get lots of money, then in the supply-side stereotype, you could give to anybody you wanted to. The Tea Partiers don't want Al Sharpton to have any money. At least no tax money. Nor do they want Goldman Sachs to have it.
Small government, fiscal conservatives, anti-kind of government bailout, for sure. That was a mobilizing issue.
Right.
Is there some kind of ambiguity in the Tea Party, your identity, in terms of social issues?
Sure. I mean, I think a lot of them are pro-life and a lot of them are pro-choice. I think it is clearly not the issue they lead on, and if it's not the issue that you lead on, then there's no real need to worry about orthodoxy on that. I mean, look, it is interesting. I'll say that it is interesting that in calendar year 2009 and 2010, we're seeing the continued advance of gay marriage here and there. The continued advance of medical marijuana, which I think is kind of a ruse for just legalizing marijuana.
Also a good way to raise taxes.
And a good way to raise revenue. Those things are happening at the same time. And other issues that used to be kind of controversial, like stem cell, as far as I can tell, have sort of disappeared off the agenda. So I do think that there is a kind of slow libertarian creep on, and I mean that in a good way, through that is happening at the same time that the right is metaphorically storming the barricades on big government. Okay. There is kind of a rejection of big government in many of its ways.
And then what about in the realm of defense? Is foreign policy another area of ambiguity, of Tea Party ambiguity? I mean, I'm all for cutting expenditures to close the deficit when you're cutting the defense budget, but how many Tea Partiers agree with me there?
I don't know.
Some do, right?
Some do. Some clearly do. Perhaps the biggest political success of the Tea Party movement, it's still yet to be determined, is Rand Paul, who is the son of Congressman Ron Paul of Texas, and Rand Paul lives in Kentucky and is running for the U.S. Senate, appears to have at least an even chance of upsetting the sort of the more orthodox Republican nominee, a fellow named Grayson, who has the support of Mitch McConnell, who's the Senate Minority Leader, an extremely powerful guy in the country, let alone Kentucky. Paul gets through the, I'm not sure it's a primary or convention, but if he ends up getting the Republican nomination there, and then I think whoever the Republican nominee is certainly the favorite in Kentucky, it's pretty much a Republican state these days, that will be a remarkable victory, and Ron Paul, now the father, and I don't think the son thinks any different, was almost thrown out of the Republican race in 2008 because he didn't support the sort of Bush-McCain orthodoxy on Iraq and Afghanistan.
Right. Although he's not a liberal on foreign policy.
He's a libertarian. I mean, he's not a liberal. He's not for foreign aid for Africa either.
He's what some might call an isolationist, and you might not. I mean, he has those kinds of tendencies.
Right, although he's a free trader, so he's not really an isolationist.
He's a free trader. Now, he's skeptical of immigration. Is that enough? That's another area where there is or is not consensus among people.
I don't think there is. Again, I think that's the strength of any movement is that they boil the message down to one or two things they can agree on and then avoid fighting over everything else.
It's the strength of a movement. But it is a reason to think that, as you said initially, you said it's not a party. It is reason to think it could never become one, right? I mean,
I think the Republican Party, and this was not a guarantee, I think the Republican Party has done a great job of co-opting most of the energy of the Tea Party movement. Now, for example, if John McCain had won in 2008, and I call me a cynic, but I think that McCain, who supported the TARP bailout and in 2008 during the campaign when it wasn't a very smart thing to do, I think he would have been doing a lot of what Obama's doing now. Mm-hmm. And then the Tea Party movement would have erupted, I think, similarly to what we're seeing now, only it would have been an intra-Republican fight with the Republican establishmentarians sticking with McCain and the Tea Partiers doing their thing. And the Democrats would have obviously been sort of cackling at the prospect of this. So again, it's sort of merciful for the Republican Party that McCain didn't win, leaving Tea Party energy to be expressed against Obama and Pelosi and Reid, as opposed to McCain, McConnell, and Boehner.
That's interesting. I think the suggestion is that a certain amount of what Obama has done is something that probably a lot of presidents, regardless of party, would have done if they inherited the economic mess he inherited. In other words, some degree of stimulus package, some kind of desperate bailout. There was a lot of bipartisan support for that.
Inside the Beltway. Not a whole lot in the country, but a lot inside the Beltway. I think that we're now discovering just how at variance the country is from the Beltway on a lot of these issues. I suspect that there's the percentage of support for bailing out Greece indirectly is about zero in the country.
I was going to ask you that. I mean, well, I was going to ask you what presumably Tea Partiers are anti-bailout for Greece. Leaving aside for now whether it actually means that much money, much of any money, has to come from Americans. I mean, most of it is coming from Europe, some from the IMF. First of all, a lot of the money, they hope, is a bluff. They've got this $1 trillion package, and they hope they have to use almost none of it. The effect is supposed to be psychological, this bailout package. Most of it comes from Europe, but I assume that you and I would assume many Tea Partiers just don't like the idea of a bailout here.
Right. Exactly. And especially the kind of bailout that the Greece bailout smells to me to be. And I've got nothing against the Greeks. I'm a fan of all the ancient Greeks and even a few modern Greeks.
Of course, they're all dead. Yeah.
I think that any honest accounting of what's going on in Europe, this is papering it over. They're kicking the can forward a year or two. I mean, Robert Samuelson in the Washington Post has been unsparing on this in the last two or three columns. And Bob, I sort of suspect that you kind of agree too that they're kicking the can forward. That they're not bluffing. They are going to wind up blowing $1 trillion.
Well, I guess I would say. I mean, one thing that definitely concerns me is the moral hazard issue. In other words, a lot of people loaned Greece money, and they probably shouldn't have. I mean, they should have looked at these Greece's fiscal situation and said, wait a second, I'm going to need a higher yield on a bond before I'm going to buy into this. If that had been the case, then Greece would have been getting the message slowly over time, hey, you got to cut back. And the trouble with a bailout is you by letting all of the people who loaned this money to Greece in the first place, who bought the Greek bonds in the first place, by letting them off the hook, you make it no less likely that they will repeat the same behavior in the future. It's the moral hazard problem. That bothers me a little.
Yeah, Bob, you sound like me. You sound like Newt Gingrich and Larry
Lindsay.
In that case,
I take it back, Jim.
I think that the lesson here is that we are kind of at a cusp here of, you know, the Western overconsumption and overspending, and again, it's not just America, and it's not just Europe, it's also Japan, of a kind of advanced welfare state-itis phenomenon that, I mean, clearly has been done at the sufferance, however perversely, of the Chinese, who seem to be paying for it all. And I don't think that it's going to last, and I think that, again, I don't think that the Washington Beltway, which is spending $3 or $4 trillion a year that it doesn't have, including, you know, $250 billion to prop up Afghanistan forever, I just don't think the support is there. I think that there's it's like that Wile E. Coyote cartoon where he goes over the cliff and there's air below him, and it takes him a while to notice, and then the plummet is pretty painful.
Well, part of the argument for the bailout was that our own fiscal health is sufficiently in doubt that actually a panic could have spread all the way to us, to our bonds, and that's one reason I think we were behind a bailout. And I will say that I don't know enough to pass judgment on whether the bailout makes sense. I recognize that a kind of legitimate part of the concern is that to the extent that a panic can set in, that really scares people beyond what is really kind of in order and can affect bond markets all over the world and lead to some giant collapse. Well, I do think it is legitimate to set up bailout packages to avert panic. That's what TARP was about. Arguably, it worked, although it's easy now that we didn't have the global collapse to say that, hey, we could have gotten by without it. I don't know that we could have. Anyway, I don't know for sure what the smart thing to do with Greece is, but it is... I hope it's a reminder that America needs to clean up its fiscal act. You just touched on something that you and I agree on, which is that one good place to save the money would be in a place where I think the expenditure right now is either wasteful or out and out counterproductive, which is Afghanistan. Are you seeing much momentum? That's a good example of something Tea Partiers would not agree on, right?
I don't know. I mean, and again, I mean, there are polls that have been done on the Tea Partiers and so on and what they believe. Two points. One is I do agree on Afghanistan. I think it's a waste of money.
At best.
Second of all, and this might surprise you, I kind of agree with you on the need for bailouts and tarps every so often just to keep the economy from going, you know, completely down the drain. There's a lot of literature on the Depression and how, you know, the crash was bad in 1929, and then a couple big banks in the U.S. and Europe failed in, like, 1931, and that sent it down another, you know, for another tumble. The real Depression started in 1931 in terms of really going to, you know, high double-digit unemployment. I think that the mistake on TARP and the mistake that both the Bush and Obama, and I would say, again, I would say McCain would have made the same mistake as well, was completely inadequate policing of the difference between bailing out the economy and guaranteeing that Lloyd Blankfein makes another $100 million a year. In other words, if as it does seem clear now, and again, there's a lot of good books, which I confess I haven't read, but just read the reviews, about the bailout and TARP and all this stuff, if it really is true that Goldman Sachs and all the rest of these big companies were, you know, two or three days away from bankruptcy, or going bust, then Tim Geithner or Hank Paulson, and again, I'm long on record as thinking both of them are completely in the tank for Wall Street, should have said, look, well, obviously you have to resign, Mr. Blankfein, and so do you, all the rest. Anybody else who's getting this kind of bailout, if we're doing it for the greater good of the economy, in the name of a sort of semi-Keynesian stability, then we're not going to shock the conscience of middle Americans and middle Europeans by letting you stay and continue to collect your you know, $100 million a year salaries.
Yeah, well, I think in principle it's probably too easy to say, but I'll say it. In principle, the ideal bailout averts the panic but distributes the cost of the bailout among the people who actually made the bad decisions, who made the bad investments. And I'm not just talking about the kind of emotionally satisfying payback to the CEOs of the investment banks. I'm talking about everyone who made an investment, you know, in a mortgage package that they shouldn't have. You know, it even includes, to some extent, the people who took out mortgages who shouldn't have, you know. I mean, ideally, everyone would take a little bit of a haircut who can afford it at all, you know, who's not going to kind of starve to death. But it's very hard to do that, I guess.
I suspect it is hard, but it's worth doing. If some think tank, and I don't know of any that are, ought to be exploring exactly that question.
You're at a think tank right now, Jim.
I know I am.
Get some people together in a seminar room. Come on. I'll get you the funding.
Well, I mean, I'll get you the funding. I mean, it's not my topic, but I think you put your finger on it, which is that, you know, again, it's not just, you know, I don't mean to pick on Lloyd Blankfein alone, and it's every greedy speculator and every real estate flipper in Florida and Arizona who bought an empty condo thinking that they would be able to sell it 3 months later for twice as what they paid for it. Everybody needs to take a haircut, even as, and I agree with this, we're mindful of, we can't have a complete panic, because that is, you know, that I think that was a real prospect, and I have, you know, some appreciation for, you know, even though I opposed the TARP bailout, that at least there was an argument there. I just think that they could have done a much better job along the lines that you're talking about.
So, you know, as far as this Greece thing goes, I mean, related to this Greece thing, does it bother you? You know, we had this short-lived Wall Street meltdown the other day where we dropped 1,000 points in minutes or something. Does it bother you that, as I understand it, we still don't understand what happened there?
Yeah, I think that there's a larger problem, and this is kind of Wrightian, that's with the W in front of it, in its dimensions.
Wrightian?
Bob, as in Bob Wright, as in Robert Wright.
Oh, excellent.
Yeah, exactly.
Excellent.
And the kind of thing think tanks should be wrestling with, which is, have we created systems that we no longer understand? They're just too complex. Nobody really has their hand. I mean, you've written a lot, Bob, about science, and you've sort of you seem a little bit associated with sort of the great man theory of science, you know, great scientists and so on.
But I'm the opposite. I think you could have killed any one famous scientist, and ultimately all of the same theories would have come about.
Okay. Well, your book, The Three Scientists and Their Gods, you know.
Yeah. Well, you gotta put people in the spotlight if you want to sell books, Jim.
I see. Okay. Well, there you have it. Okay. So what you think and what you wrote are a little bit different. Fair enough.
No, I didn't write anything inconsistent with what I just said.
In any case. The question is, and Wall Street is the best example of this, and maybe the macroeconomy, and maybe to some extent computers and so on. Does anybody know how this stuff works? A great example of the kind of an issue which is related is on the front page of the Washington Post. This is Wednesday's Washington Post about the State Department or I guess Congress kind of earmarking $15 million to hack through. The Chinese, what they call the Great Firewall of China.
Now is this the thing they're giving to Falun Gong, the religious group?
Yeah, right,
I'm curious what you think of that. I'm very much against that myself. Are you in favor of it?
No. I think it's kind of an act of war against China.
It just seems stupid to me.
I don't particularly think the Chinese will appreciate it.
I don't think so.
And what I fear, though, is that the Chinese are like ultimately smarter than we are. And that if we walk down this cyber arms race, where it's tit for tat, tat for tit, you know, back and forth, I think we're going to wind up not being able to do blogging heads in the future because the Chinese have shut us down. That's an example of, I don't think that any member of Congress, and I might be short shrifting a couple of them, but I don't think that. Almost no members of Congress have the technical capacity to understand these internet issues. So they're voting on something that they truly don't know how it works. This has been a point that's been made about the Supreme Court as well, that, you know, whenever the Supreme Court is called upon to deal with, you know, internet issues, and there's a case, I don't know how to pronounce it, Q-U-O-N, it's about text messaging in Ontario, California. Mm-hmm. And this was that somebody, some blogger was making the point that, look, none of the Supreme Court justices knew anything about the technical reality of this issue. Yeah. Now, that's not their fault. I mean, the world changes quickly. But the larger question is, do we have systems on the Internet and on Wall Street and maybe on the macroeconomy that nobody understands?
Yeah, I mean, in a way, it's amazing to me that the global economy runs as well as it does. When you look at the way basically, you know, over time, decades, centuries, it just kind of constructed itself as a result of individual people making small decisions like, yeah, I want to get a personal computer. Yeah, I'll buy this software. Yeah, I'll write this software and I can sell it. Yeah, I can sell this software to this investment bank. You know, it's like nobody said, let's construct a giant global economic behemoth of a machine, you know, and yet here it is. You're right. Nobody understands it, and of course the meltdown of 08 is the perfect example of how nobody really clearly understood the interrelationship among the various financial instruments they had built. Nobody kind of understands it, and yet it hasn't totally fallen apart yet. It's kind of remarkable. We should almost be grateful that the system almost has enough intrinsic logic behind it that. We can kind of muddle through, but there's the kind of separate question, leaving aside the sheer complexity of the system, the issue of, like, turning over decision-making authority to computers. In other words, writing the programs and then letting them go. I mean, one idea is that that's what happened on Wall Street with this meltdown, is that it was Hal in 2001, or whatever, was that, what's the name of that? Was that the year that movie was...
The movie was 2001. The film came out in 69.
And Hal was a computer, and it was just like, hey, you know, who are we to tell this computer what to do? It wants the Dow to drop 1,000 points, you know. You build this elaborate software, and you turn more and more decisions over, you know, more and more computers are the ones actually flying the planes and so on. And there are obviously a lot of benefits to doing this, a lot of efficiencies. But you realize every once in a while that you're in the hands of something you've built and yet don't understand.
Right. I agree with that. And I would point out that although you're sort of paying to the economy as the cumulative product of you know, individual entrepreneurs and consumers and so on, it's very Hayekian, and I agree with that. Basically, you know, it is basically, you know, free people and people making choices and so on that make the market around the world go and give it a kind of robustness to it that even so if one country goes, you know, off the rails, the rest of the world doesn't necessarily follow. I would point out, though, that every now and then some thinker has come along and conceived of a system that gave others, in effect, indirectly their marching orders. You know, Adam Smith and Ricardo come to mind in the late 18th, early 19th century. John Maynard Keynes comes to mind at the middle of the 20th century.
You mean an idea that helps us figure out how to handle the system?
Right, an idea that a governing, you know, Kybernan of an idea. You know, free trade is one. Sort of managed trade, which is sort of where the Keynesians come down, as another. You know, what sort of the Asian tigers have been doing, you know, as a kind of neo-mercantilism, I guess, is another. You know, and at one time in one period, you can say, well, that was a good strategy, or that was a good strategy, or that was a good strategy. You know, the Arnold Toynbee in me says that, you know, when you hit a crisis, you need a new response, or you need a response, and it better be a good one. And it is, you know, not been clear to me for a long time that you know, for example, that free trade with China, defined as sending our supply chains over to China, is a good policy for America in terms of industry and military defense and economic growth. And somebody's going to have to rethink that, you know, a real economist, not just, you know, somebody popping off. But it's clear that, and I think this is sort of what Obama's up against, which is just printing a few trillion dollars and handing it out, although that's sort of a vulgar Keynesianism. It doesn't meet the other test of Keynesianism, which is, are you creating new industries and new power sources for your domestic economy? I don't see any of that going on at all.
Yeah, I don't know. I'm not sure I have anything intelligent to say. Yeah.
Oh, come on, Bob.
Well, I mean, I'm not sure I'm as concerned about China as you are. I'm not as generally concerned as you are, and I'm a pretty concerned person.
Put it this way: do you think that the Chinese mean us well?
Oh, I think the Chinese are more or less like us. They want things to work out to their economic advantage.
Okay.
And
what about military advantage? We want things to work out to our military advantage too.
I think they're smart enough to understand that that what they would like to do is get by without having to exert any great and dramatic military force. Now they want to. I think they want to build up their military to a point where they don't get pushed around. What I would say is, I don't think. I mean, everyone would like to, I guess, use their military for the subtle exercise of force. I don't think they want a war.
I don't think they want a war either. But I would point out to you that when they feel the pressure, they're pretty good at using force.
Ask, we have been too.
I understand that. I ask the Tibetans. Ask Falun Gong. I think that what we see to be Chinese subtlety and nuance in terms of, oh, their Confucian ways and so on, is weakness. And when they get strong, when they have, you know, a GDP that's bigger than America's or comparable, whatever, I think that we'll see a military buildup similar to that.
But I don't think they have any aspiration of ultimately conquering land. I mean, of course, Taiwan is a special delicate issue, and war could break out there. But I don't think they plan fundamentally to advance their interests through war.
How would you know either way?
Well, how would you? I mean, I wouldn't, except
to study the arc of all great powers.
Well, yeah, but there is a difference now. There is a difference, and it's the degree of economic interdependence and the extent to which it is truly global. I mean, you know, one way of looking at it is, you know, China can extract about as much value through trade with other countries as it could through conquest, more, because conquest is messy and expensive.
Yeah, then why do they have all these troops in Africa now?
Well, why do we have all of our troops plan to conquer the world?
Well, no, I think, Bob.
Where do they have troops? And I genuinely don't know as much as maybe you do.
They have workers who are People's Liberation Army members all over Africa. Everybody knows.
Doing
that.
What?
Like construction and mining and things like
well,
that.
Well, so they have construction and mining workers.
But it's military.
That's a different way to say it.
They're not
exercising military force.
No, but it's unmistakable where they're headed.
Where?
It's toward
the extraction of resources.
Dominating those resource-rich countries.
Absolutely, they would like to the extent that they can.
Right.
They, by and large, do that by making deals with these countries that these countries find to be in their interest.
Yeah, but Bob, who are they making the deals with?
Dictators.
Okay, that's not a deal with the country. And you say they can make a deal with Robert
Mugabe.
Who
do we make our deals with? Who's
Bob?
Visiting America right now? Karzai. A corrupt guy who probably cheated his way past the last election. We deal with whoever's in power, Jim.
I understand that. Well, except when we change their government, as a footnote.
Well, right.
I think at least China hasn't invaded anybody lately
to change their government, which we have done.
I understand. Look, Bob, we basically agree on this. I mean, we're both essentially saying that countries operate in a realist way of which the military is one tool.
But a tool of declining utility over the centuries, and I think the Chinese understand that.
That's your non-zero stuff, and I don't agree with that. I think, well, then tell me,
why is it that over the past 60 years, there's been no war among the great powers, among the most economically advanced nations? When was the last time 60 years passed without that happening, Jim?
Somewhere in the past, I'm sure, Roman Empire times. The point is, America was the hegemon. If you were a member of NATO or Japan, you weren't going to get in a war with anybody because the Americans wouldn't let you. I think that you and I agree that historians will someday call the American system, emerging from 1945. Cratered somewhere in the last decade or so. And now we're gonna wake up and realize that China and India are major nuclear, military, economic powers with ambitious space programs and everything else. And then them doing pretty much what we do, although I like to think we're nicer, but maybe not everybody agrees. They're inevitably going to be colliding with each other. That's Hans Morgenthau's point, you know,
read your Morgenthau. He acknowledged in what's the fundamental book, Power Among Nations or something, one of his fundamental texts, whatever it's called. He acknowledged, you know, he's the realist thinker of the 20th century, the realist theorist in foreign policy. He says, look, it may be the case that as the world changes technologically, socially, things advance, that someday the realist position is to be for world government. He said
maybe,
that in the book.
Bob, it doesn't make it true. Look, I think it's really, really clear that world government defined as the world government run by the United States would be tolerable to Americans and a number of other people around the world. I might even venture to say our world government would be pretty popular in as big a chunk of the world as anybody's world government. However, nobody's world government, including America's, is about to happen. The world is going the other way.
Wait a second. We just saw, and first of all, I'm not advocating world government. I would advocate something that would qualify as global governance, but I would argue we're seeing that. The Greece bailout, like it or not, Jim, that is the world's powers, economic powers, getting together in an institutional forum, the International Monetary Fund, the European Union, getting together and solving a problem that they see as hugely transnational
by virtue
of modern technology.
Except that you and I agreed it wasn't solved.
Well, I explicitly said I don't know what the smart policy is.
No,
I will say this. What you saw was an institutional response on an international level that is comparable to what you used to see as an institutional response on a national level back in the days when economic organization and interdependence was more confined to nations.
Right.
So that you are seeing the evolution of global governance for better or worse.
I think you're seeing the Indian summer of the European Union. I don't think the European Union will exist in a capacity to do that 5 years from now.
The EU may have overreached. Right. We don't know. I mean, I would say, I mean, what we've seen highlighted with Greece is the downside of currency unification across different nations and cultures. And people knew at the beginning, back when they start, when they did the currency unification, people said, you have certain problems here. For example, the labor market is not as fluid. When the Rust Belt in the Midwest goes bad, well, all the unemployed workers can just move to California or the South. They speak the same language, it's the same government, and this is not going to be so easy in Europe. And they're right. But I will say, we shouldn't forget that during the period of currency unification, there have been all these kinds of quiet and subtle economic efficiencies by virtue of the unification that have surely had some upside, and now we're seeing the downside. And I don't know whether it's smart or not, but I agree, I take your point that the EU right now, its continued integrity is not beyond doubt.
Right, and I think the same is clearly true of the United Nations. I think that the only agency of the UN that had any kind of efficacy was the Security Council, and now that doesn't either, because there's a guaranteed 2 votes against whatever the Americans do, which is to say China and Russia. So, I mean, I think that, again, I'm not against it. You don't even need two.
The single nation
veto. You're right. But the argument is, well, one wouldn't go by itself. You know, they'd be too lonely. So I think it is possible to envision some new structure, some new, I use the word Kybernan, you know, some new sort of leadership system. You know, but I don't think it'll be this. I think it'll be dramatically different. And again, that's a good, you know, Bob Wright level thing to think about. But I think that what's really clear though is that the 20th century assumptions about, well, countries will naturally trade more and get along better and so on and so on, you know, have fallen asunder to what we now see is that all this sort of peacefulness within sort of the West was a function of American power. And, you know, when Hugo Chavez can thumb his nose, and again, I'm not saying that Hugo Chavez is a great Satan. To me, he's just some sort of Venezuelan nationalist. But when a Latin American nationalist can thumb his nose at America and bring in the Russians and the Iranians and, you know, every other enemy of America, and you know, give him, you know, who knows what he's doing? We'll find out, I suspect. Then all of a sudden, it doesn't look so safe anymore. It doesn't look so secure.
But wait, I think let's be clear. I mean, if peace among nations was indeed a product of American hegemony, then I would ask, why is it that as American hegemony has manifestly declined, we're not seeing any increase in war among economically advanced nations, or really in war generally by historical standards? The great threat, and this I acknowledge, I mean, my view is increasingly war among nation states is a manageable problem, but the new emerging threat is these non-state actors. Witness the Times Square would-be bomber. I acknowledge that that's a threat, but I just don't see the evidence that we're going to see some outbreak of war among nations. And I just think your concern is, I mean, it's a problem we need to stay on top of, but I think if that's kind of where much of your national security thinking is going, it's misplaced. Well, I think a great threat, and it's a very significant one, is these non-state actors and terrorism and so on.
We completely agree on that. I guess if state actors weren't still an issue and that their relationships with each other weren't still an issue, then why are all these countries building nuclear weapons?
Oh, for various reasons. It does bestow a kind of power, first of all, as a matter of deterrence. Look, I mean, Iran is right next door to Iraq, which we had invaded. Now, Iran is thinking, well, I'll bet that if Iraq had nuclear weapons, rather than being suspected of building them, but actually was thought to have them, I'll bet they would have been reluctant to invade. That's one thing Iran may be thinking, right? So right. deterrence is a rational reason to have nuclear weapons. And more cynically, I'll get a little more cynical, it allows Iran to throw around its weight in some ways we won't like with less fear of military retaliation, precisely because nuclear weapons are an effective deterrent.
I agree with both of those points. Now,
but Iran is more of an example of the danger. See, Iran is a hybrid case because there the threat is largely how they deploy force via non-state actors.
Okay, and I think that ask the Saudi Arabians. I think the Saudi Arabians and are genuinely nervous that one day the Iranians are going to come and conquer them if the Americans left. If the Americans were to leave. So, I think that if you have a situation where 20 or 30 countries have nuclear weapons, and they're using them for deterrence, and they're using them to throw their weight around, all the things you said,
that's
a 1914 all over again.
That gets scary,
It's just a question of getting lucky, of whether or not you and I pass from this mortal coil before that goes.
Right, but I don't see an alternative. If you want to head that off, that scenario off, I don't see an alternative, as unlikely as it may be, but to pursue something you could call global governance, to revise the Non-Proliferation Treaty to where it really has teeth. I think the American government has not done a good job of handling the non-proliferation issue in the last decade. I agree with you. It scares me to death, not only because because the amount of international instability grows, that is to say, instability among nations, the more nuclear weapons you have, or at least the threat of something going wrong grows, even though in some respects it can actually be stabilizing. But, of course, the danger grows of something falling into the hands of terrorists.
Right, which is why I'm for homeland security, I'm for missile defense, and I think you kind of agree with me on this, and I'm for space exploration. I just think that the planet is too small for 6, 7, 8, 9, 10 billion people, a lot of whom, both in and out of governments, have nuclear weapons. I think that the reality that we're going to lose a city somewhere in the world, and then the homeland security crackdown then will make life genuinely unpleasant for a lot of us. And that's when people in history have started saying, I want someplace new to go to. I want to go to Australia. I want to go to America. I want to go to,
Mars.
Alaska. Mars. Mars would be good. But I think that it's comical to think that you're going to get major powers like China and India and America and Europe and Iran having anything other than a completely, tissue-thin governing regime. I don't think Israel would be part of it. I think you and I would probably agree that the American effort to stop Iran from having nuclear weapons is sort of foundered now on the issue of a nuclear-free Middle East.
Not just Israel, but India and Pakistan. I think we've made the mistake of basically having implicitly a policy that, look, our friends can have nuclear weapons outside of the Non-Proliferation Treaty, that is India, Pakistan, and Israel, but your friends can't, and that's an untenable position.
Right, I agree with that. It's untenable, but the point is global governance, there's about 1,000 of them. I mean, take the biggest attempt, and I don't even know how you feel about all this, at global governance that started afresh in the last decade, and that's global warming, climate change.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, if there's ever something that the great and the good across the world agreed upon, they might not have agreed on the Iraq War, and they might not have agreed on trade and a million other things, but every sort of high-minded, pious intellectual in the world was signed on to the global warming thing, and the whole thing has cratered. And now we have this stink to high heaven level of intellectual and scientific corruption on the issue that I think is has for a long time to come poisoned any public trust toward a climate change regime that I don't think would have worked anyway, because I don't think the Chinese would ever have abided by it. But I don't think the Americans will abide by it now.
Yeah, well, on the other hand, climate change is the most difficult kind of problem because it's not only a collective action problem that requires coordination among a bunch of nations to solve. But the downside, it's also an intergenerational equity problem because you do stuff now to stave off disaster like 50 years from now. Well, you know, people's time horizons are not that long. So I would say, you know, you've chosen what is almost the most, you know, the least likely area for policy success to begin with. You're right. It's now not looking good. What do you think of the oil spill, by the way? Speaking of which, what effect is that going to have?
You know, I mean, I think it's terrible. I think it's atrocious. I wrote a book 15 years ago in which I said the government ought to try and do a few things well rather than a lot of things badly.
These were your new paradigm days?
Yeah, what comes next. And in that book, I had a section on what I call samurai bureaucrats, which is to say that, look, if the things that we really want done properly, and let me just jump in here and say, regulation of natural resources and pollution is one of those things that we want, yes, the government to do, we want the government to do it well. And if you want the government to do a good job, then you the governors, the bureaucrats, have to have honor, esteem, power, position, authority, you know, responsibility, all those things. And you know, the example I used was a samurai. If a samurai in Imperial Japan did a bad job, you know what happened to him.
They killed him?
He killed himself. Mm. He would say, I'm so ashamed of my failure that I'm going to kill myself. And I meant that a little tongue-in-cheek, but it's...
I'm actually in favor of it.
Well, see, I mean, the point is, if you believe in responsibility and authority, then you have to have a system that the only institution in the government, you know, we read about the Securities Exchange Commission, they all surf around for porn all the time while the market crashes and stuff like that. And actually a few people, the porn surfers, and apparently about 20 of them, did in fact retire or resign, which means, you know, that we can imagine they get pensions and, you know, they're probably living on more money now than they made when they in their jobs.
You know, what they should do is they should not only send them to prison, but deny them internet access. That is punishment.
Nobody thinks, it didn't even occur to anybody, you know, sort of in the chattering class, newspaper reading, TV watching, internet surfing community, to say, well, why didn't the chairman of the SEC resign over this? You know, I mean, I'm not saying that, you know, I mean, Mary Shapiro might be a valuable person, but somehow we've lost the notion that when the government fails, somebody, Ken Salazar, why is Ken Salazar, the Interior Secretary, still on the job? Now, the only exception to this rule about accountability in the U.S. government I can see is the military. In the military, if you do a bad job, you get court-martialed, or you lose your job. You're no longer in the service. And guess what? Pound for pound, and again, I agree with you on Iraq. You and I always have agreed on Iraq and Afghanistan. But the military, and David Petraeus, the general, you know, he's at least somebody who is trying. He is taking seriously.
Oh, he's a very impressive guy.
He's a very impressive guy. We agree. He's a very impressive guy, yeah. And I see no similar impressiveness across most of the federal government, including whoever was in charge of keeping track of the Minerals and Management Service. And again, they apparently were having orgies rather than, you know, keeping track of oil wells. I think it's atrocious, and I would be having the civilian equivalent of courts martial.
Yeah, of course, at last check, they couldn't even get the responsibility nailed down as far as BP versus Halliburton versus some other contractor. I mean, it seems to me legally it's actually clear. BP is responsible. It's their job to hire responsible subcontractors.
Right. I'll say something else. I don't think that BP should be a corporation anymore after this.
Excellent.
I think that, you know, the corporate charter, you know, is now sort of something you send $200 to some lawyer in Delaware and you get a piece of paper that says you're a corporation. At one time, well into the 19th century, you know, you had to prove that you were going to do something useful. The reason you're going to have this corporate immunity to debts and so on is that we think you're going to do something important, like, you know, build a railroad from here to Cincinnati.
Mm-hmm.
I would take away that BP's corporate charter and let them think that not only are they going to pay the, you know, $20 billion cleanup or whatever it's going to be, but it would actually come out of their incomes, and maybe they'd go to debtor's prison, too. I mean, that
but wouldn't that mean that immediately all their stockholders were holding assets that were worthless? Not that that's a bad thing.
No, I think that's part, again, we were saying before, and I thought you made a good point.
Moral hazard. They shouldn't have bought
everybody gets a haircut. I mean, again, you shouldn't just think that it's sort of a cost of doing business when some kind of catastrophe happens like this. Mm-hmm. And you got to start somewhere. And again, I worry about ex post facto. So maybe I don't mean it when I say BP should.
Well, an alternative.
But I would pass a law tomorrow saying this going forward, anything this bad, you no longer exist.
Well, here's what I would say: is the cost that that BP pays should not be confined to the cost of cleanup. We should somehow estimate the cost that's been done to the environment and the American economy in spite of the cleanup. And, like, a pretty big chunk of that is what they should... I mean, the liability is theirs.
I agree. But having said that, I think that we should then say, having just gotten through hammering, you know, BP and any other old company that does the same thing, that the Interior Department, I mean, there should be a decimation at the Interior Department, too.
Well, apparently, Obama, the administration, I guess, has already determined that when you look at the regulatory agency that handles this, there's a kind of a conflict of interest. I haven't even read the piece beyond the first paragraph, but apparently they want to break up some regulatory agency because the agency was spending half of its time doing business with the oil companies, you know, and the other half supposedly being a watchdog, and that's not tenable. There's a conflict of interest.
Right, I agree that's not tenable. And again, those are the things that, that make me nervous as an American about President Obama. I don't, and not that I, as you know, I never had much good to say about President Bush either. I worry that our presidents don't, and again, this back to systems that are too complex, they don't really know how the government runs. You know, I didn't know, you didn't know about the permanent institutional conflict of interest at the Minerals Management Service.
And if either
you or I had heard about it, we might have had a contrary opinion. I expect most Americans would have said, well, that's
pretty stupid. I mean, I understand how it happens. I mean, you enter office, and it's just like entering a hurricane, right? When you're president, there's so much stuff to deal with. You're just treading water. I mean, I can imagine how you would not manage to go sniff out all of the parts of the bureaucracy where there is suboptimal performance that's not immediately creating a crisis, you know?
Yeah, you're right, and that's why we have a lousy government. And so we're going to we'll have a lousy government, and therefore a Tea Party movement, until somebody you know hires the best and the brightest at the Kennedy School and more to the point West Point, mm-hmm. and says, look, go in there agency by agency and figure it out,
mm-hmm.
And then we'll deal with the Congress after that. But I mean it's all the time that President Obama was saying the most important thing we have to do is do climate change, and the most important thing we have to do is health care. The normal, quotidian functions of the government were, walking on banana peels.
Yeah. Where should we go to from there? We were going to, two things we were going to talk about. I guess we don't have time for both. One was the Times Square bomber. The other was epistemic closure.
Your choice, Bob. You're the leader of this white
heads
community.
You know, Petraeus effort. Put me in. I mean, something we disagree on probably is the implications of the Times Square bomber. I actually wrote something that I think you probably haven't read that appeared online in the New York Times today, where I did the predictable thing. You know, blame America first. I pointed out that if you look at the close calls we've had, well, one of which was more than a close call, the Fort Hood shooting, the various attempted or successful terrorist attacks on America over the last year, underwear bomber, Fort Hood shooter, and then this guy. Now, first of all, not that this means that America is to blame or that these guys are excused, but the fact is that there is reason to believe that all of them were incited by American policies, some of which I believe were dubious to begin with, such as the invasion of Iraq, the surge in Afghanistan, the drone strikes in Pakistan, and so on. So
I agree with you.
You agree with that part?
It's pure blowback. I mean, we bomb them, they bomb us.
Yeah, and what bothers me, a couple of things bother me. One is that you can see how it's in the interests of a president are overwhelmingly to prevent a terrorist attack over the next year or two. And I don't doubt that if that's your goal, it may be that those drone strikes in Pakistan, maybe they help on balance. But in the long run, they are turning more and more people who live in America into potential terrorist agents. And so what bothers me is that the incentive for a politician is to focus on the short term in a way that increases the long term peril to America. Does that make sense?
Yeah, I agree with that too. However, at some point you are required to have a suitably no-nonsense approach to domestic security.
This is where we will disagree. Go ahead.
I think I might have horrified Ann Allhouse on this very show recently when I predicted that.
Did you say horrified or glorified?
Horrified.
Okay.
She's a great blogging heads her, and she's a nice woman.
And she's glorious, so she doesn't need glorification.
She has a glorious academic career, but I said that I'm now increasingly of the view that Eric Holder will be remembered as the A. Mitchell Palmer of the 21st century. A. Mitchell Palmer was Woodrow Wilson's attorney general.
I'm horrified that you even know that, but go ahead.
Yeah, who was a Quaker. I mean, when, as Attorney General, the anarchists of the post-World War I era blew up his house and killed a bunch of other people and so on, in terrorist attacks across America and across the world. And the Palmer raids were a crackdown on, quote, Reds, unquote, that horrified, created the ACLU in response and horrified civil libertarians, but stopped the anarchism. I think that I have no doubt that Eric Holder had every intention of being the Attorney General who would increase diversity and help affirmative action and you know, advance civil liberties and see all the Gitmo people tried in civilian trials and if not let go and given furloughs and so on. And I think that the experience of what he's doing, and now to say, well, maybe the Miranda warnings aren't such a good idea, just shows how, you know, the requirements of holding office and doing the job put in front of you and getting briefed not by the ACLU but getting briefed by extremely serious-minded Homeland Security types with very, very scary scenarios, I think will turn Holder into another Palmer.
Well, whether you may be right predictively that he will respond that way, but I don't think it's a good idea. And in fact, I think the Miranda thing would be another example of doing what you think will help in the short term at the expense of various long-term costs. And I think a crackdown on American Muslims, I know you think mosques should be monitored more than I think they should be and so on. I think that, like these foreign policy misadventures, ultimately increases the number of people who are sufficiently discontented that they could become terrorists. And so,
right, I think the difference, though, is that we can change one thing, and we can change both. I think it is possible, look, someday within the next 5 years, I think you and I basically agree on this, if we're lucky, we're going to have some peace treaty with Pakistan where we no more drones and they agree to crack down on their local people, you know, their people over there coming over here to kill us. And then we're going to be left with what I consider to be the relatively small challenge of Homeland Security. It's not that hard. It's only hard when you have the Warren Court making it hard. If you just leave it up to the cops, it's kind of a breeze to say, look, sorry, you can't blow up any buildings here.
I don't think it is a breeze. I think it's shocking to me that there has not been more terrorism on American soil because it's so easy to do. It's heartening that these guys are so incompetent. But face it, Jim, it's not that hard to kill a few people and not get caught. It really isn't.
Well, actually, I think that's where the IRA experience probably tells us differently. I mean, the Irish have been hating the British for, 800 years. And again, I remember, you and I basically agree on the sort of foreign blowback issue. So, the Protestants should have thought twice before they invaded Ireland and, in the Middle Ages and sort of ever since, and realized that if they then let a ton of Irish come to England to, live and work, that they've got a base there for the IRA. That was just, that'll teach them. But I think, what the British have is all these cameras everywhere, and I think that seems to have worked to squelch the IRA.
We will certainly see more of that. And you're right, it does make it harder to get to get away with it, and it's not the worst way to make it hard to get away with it. I mean, so long as it's the case that, look, the videotape is just not going to get reviewed unless there's valid reason to review it, so we don't have to all worry, you know, about people checking up on our day-to-day business. Although that guy, I mean, just to, if you remember, right, the day after the Times Square bombing, and this to me was a little alarming, that if you were, do you remember when there was like 24 or 36 hours where there was this video of a guy who was a person of interest, and he took off his shirt and he put
right,
it
right, right, yeah,
and,
no,
he, I, and he glanced furtively. I mean, I look, that to me, the fact that we were focused on that was a sign of how freaked out and irrational people get. I looked at that once. And once I learned that we had not seen him coming out of the car, but we just knew he was coming from the area, I said, there's no way this is the guy.
That's an interesting case. And I wonder, and again, to give the cops some due, I wonder whether they were, and again, this will all get, you know, written about and chronicled and so on, whether the cops were doing that on purpose to make Shizuo think he was.
I wish I could think so.
I wish I could too, and I hope, and I'm not saying I know I'm right, I'm just speculating, like, that there's two possibilities. Either the cops just had the wrong guy and didn't know it for a while, or they wanted Shazad to think they had the wrong guy.
I wish I could give them, you know, that much credit, but I don't blame them for thinking, hey, you know, there's a chance. Look, yeah, there was a 1 in 1,000 chance, but, you know, there was just almost no chance that this was the guy. And it was on the front page of all the newspaper sites, and it was absurd. I thought it was me at first. I've done that a million times in New York. It's a hot day. You stop. You change your shirt. He looked over his shoulder as if somebody had just made a noise or something. He didn't look suspicious at all. It was crazy.
Well, the point, but in any case, what's clear is that pretty good, not perfect, but pretty good police work got this. And
yeah.
We will then know a great deal about the Pakistani Taliban and whoever else helped him and things like that. And there's, I think police work does succeed on this. Now, again, you along the way here, if we have a permanent problem or a long-term problem, then obviously we've got to think about immigration a little more intelligently, because you don't want more people coming over here if they might have these, Robert Pape. Yeah, that's a University of Chicago professor who I think, again, we both admire, have these Robert Papish instincts. We just can't have them in your country.
Well, by Robert Papish instincts, you mean?
Robert Pape is a University of Chicago professor who wrote a book a few years ago called Dying to Win, which he says that suicide bombers...
Who emphasizes that terrorism is very often a response to foreign occupation.
Terrorism is a kind of defense.
And
again, I'm not saying anything else, but you and I are not fans of terrorists at all, and we're not conceptualizing or sympathizing or anything.
Right.
We're just sort of observing that sort of the political equivalent of physics says that if Mr. Shazad is here reading about his countrymen getting blown up by drone missiles, it might affect his thinking.
It might. I mean, as for immigration, look, I think immigration law should be enforced. I think there is some limit on how rapidly any nation can assimilate immigrants. All I would say is, if there is a tightening on the rate at which we want to see the influx, I would want it to be to not discriminate with respect to ethnicity or origin. I think it would be a smarter policy for it to be, across the board. I mean, obviously, as a practical day-to-day matter, they are going to give close scrutiny to people who want to immigrate from say Pakistan, but in terms of total quotas, I think that would be a bad and counterproductive policy to make those discriminatory on that basis.
Well, let's just hope that you're never giving political advice to some candidate.
Well, I don't think we have to worry about that.
I think the candidate who says, "Oh no, I thought that England and Yemen were just equally good places to have people come from," I don't think that'll play very well in the next 5 or 10 years.
Well, it may not play with the public. There's a lot of policies that I'm in favor of that don't seem to engender the enthusiasm of the American people, and maybe that just means they're bad ideas. But I'm not willing to admit that yet, Jim Peterson. However, our time, alas, has expired.
Yes.
So another great conversation with you. Didn't get to everything I'd hoped to get to, and got into some cosmic areas I hadn't anticipated, but that's the way it is with you.
Well, Bob, you too. Thank you, as always, and talk to you soon.
All right, take care. All right, bye.